Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is one of the earlier programs of 2020, and so I thought it would be a good opportunity to sort of look back a little before we start looking ahead at what we expect for the next decade or so. And so to do this looking back, we're going to have a series of guests from all of the four major areas of science, and this will get controversial straight away: chemistry, biology, physics, and geology. There are other areas, and we might delve into those a little later. But to start out with, the first program or two will be associated with biology or biological sciences. It's such a big field. And I guess chemical sciences, which is equally big, covering materials and pharmaceuticals as it can do. So who's going to look back and tell us what was big this year? Well, for biology, we'll do alphabetically. We've got Bruce Cushing. He's the chair of the Department of Biological Sciences at UT El Paso and is a neuroscientist. And he's also very interested in voles. Now, I don't know if that'll come up, but if you're out there and you're on campus and want to see a vole or two, Bruce is the man to go to. And for the chemistry, we've got Professor Luis Echegoyen, who's been a guest on the program before. He is the Welch Professor of Chemistry at UT El Paso and is the president of the American Chemical Society for the year 2020. His interests are in carbon chemistry, in particular, from my point of view, his wonderful work on buckyballs, which you've probably all heard about. So there we are. These are the two guests for the program. We're going to look back at their idea of what they think was important and then have a sort of generalized discussion of what they have unearthed. We'll start with Bruce. So tell us, in biological sciences, amply defined, what do you think's been important for the last year?
Well, I think that there's a number of areas, and we can look at things from sort of the way my department is divided up into biomedical versus more of the ecological and evolutionary fields. So I think a lot of them are the advancements on things that have been developed over the past decade, some of which include things like the real implication of CRISPR technology. CRISPR.
Oh, CRISPR. Yes, indeed.
Which is clusters of regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats, which is why we come up with things like CRISPRs. And yes, those are related to chemistry as well. Biology and chemistry are sort of the same thing, because biology doesn't exist without the chemicals that make us
Biology is just chemistry inside cells and bodies, and living
well,
bodies.
Maybe. We can argue about that one more if we need to. But I think that that technology, CRISPR, has been a major advancement. It's been around for most of a decade, and actually earlier than that, but it's really blossomed, and that's because it can be used. So if you're not familiar with it, it's a way to actually cut out genes. So it's a bacterial function. It's an enzyme, Cas9 is what it's called, where bacteria would cut out viral DNA that infected the bacteria. So in reality, the bacteria could sort of cure itself from a disease.
So it's been done naturally for forever.
Right. Well, right. If you look at biology, most of our advancements are actually things that organisms use, and then we do them better, or we use X-rays to see things. And so what's been done with it is it's a mechanism now where you can cut out and replace specific genes. So it has potential.
So you can only cut them out. You can't modify them.
Well, no, so what you do is you cut them out, and then when you cut them out, you repair the DNA. The DNA can be repaired one of two ways, and that is either to try and glue the ends back together, which usually screws things up, something awful in a normal system, or what the DNA will do, the organism will do, is insert another gene, another section in there. So what we can do now is control where it cuts, so a scissor is cutting it, and then we can direct what gets replaced. So it gives you the chance to find out what genes do and how they work. And, you know, Luis, maybe you want to comment on that as well, how they can work. So you can look at what they do. You can also use it to try to modify diseases and take genes out that might be bad. So it has both a potential use for curing disease, although we're not there yet, and then also a tremendous opportunity to understand how genes work and what they do.
And what turns them on and turns them off.
Right,
because
turns
that's
them on,
a
turns
feature
them
that's
off
puzzled
and,
me.
And, you know, what role particular forms of genes play modifications do, and then we can do these in organisms like fruit flies. You can do it in anything. You can do it in voles, fruit flies, humans. It's really a tremendous...
if I may say something, please. That's where the ethical issues come in, because there was a case, I forget now if it was in Korea or something like that, someone decided that they were going to play God, basically, and they designed the genes and they modified the properties and everything, the whole genome of a particular, I think it was... In humans, right? It was done in humans. I don't remember the details, but the ethical implications are tremendous. And if I may add something else, I just saw, because I have CRISPR on my list also, because there's a lot of chemistry involved. It turns out when you put in the piece, the percent that goes in successfully is like 15% or so. And very recently, someone did chemical modification of the ends. It turns out to be instability of the DNA chunk, and they increase the stability by chemistry. I mean, just doing modifications, chemical modifications, and they went up to 65% of introduction of the gene.
And so then that means the other 45 or 85% is just screwed up gene.
That's correct.
Well, that's got to be a bit of an issue.
It is an issue.
Before it's be out there as a...
Medically, I think it has a long way to go. I mean, it's like artificial intelligence, which is another thing probably on both of our lists, where the idea is really good. Our ability to make them work, plus the fact that biological systems, we still don't know anywhere near as much as we want to. And the other thing, the other issue that could be serious with this is that these also can function as gene drivers. So in other words, they can function to drive stability and the evolution of the gene or how it stays or the increase in the population. And if we do things like that in agriculture, which is one place this is also talked about using for, we might actually reduce diversity. And if we reduce genetic diversity, then that also can be a disaster as we deal with another issue that's really critical where we're dealing with climate change. Because we may limit organisms' abilities to respond, and those could become runaway. I mean, these are the same things we talked about with genetic gene-modified products. So these all still exist.
But the genetically modified food, for example, they would make a wheat that was resistant to some little pest. What you're saying, though, and I hadn't realized this, that CRISPR is giving us the opportunity to develop our own future genome.
Correct.
Well, that's bloody scary. I mean, because I don't know how one controls who makes decisions about what traits. You know, I mean, I've got blue eyes, so I'm told. Everybody might want blue eyes, or I'll be ostracized, you know, because people start putting in genetic little markers that say, no more blue eyes. You're already isolated. This is something I didn't realize was... Who's doing this? Where is the driver for the modification into the future of our own genome?
Well, I mean, that's a really interesting question because it's being done on such a massive scale. I mean, right now CRISPR is on the verge of becoming a tool that can be used in any species, and everybody talks about doing it. So there will be very little control over who does what other than through the funding agencies. So if you want to do something and you're requesting money, then they'll have control over whether or not you get funds to do this. But eventually it will be so inexpensive.
I was going to say.
Will reach a point where pretty much anybody will be able to do it. But it's a very simple technique.
But the driving force, I think that's what you were asking, what are people doing and what are they trying to do? And it turns out that many genes have been identified as being particularly, and I'm not a biologist, so Bruce can interject and correct me if I'm saying something wrong. There are some genes that if you have them, you know that your likelihood of having this cancer or that or whatever. So you can go in there and just edit your own gene and take that gene out and eliminate the chances or increased possibilities of having or developing a certain type of cancer. So you can use it.
I get that point. But then the other point about this inefficiency of inserting, but in this case, there's no insertion. So, I mean, do people even have a clue? Well, that you just can't go in and pick out this piece of the genome without the whole thing modified.
If you take something out, you need to put something in part because you have to heal it, right? And if you alter the base sequences, then the problem is that you'll mess up whatever's going to happen beyond that. You're never just dealing with a gene. You're always dealing with a DNA and a chromosome. You don't just turn on one thing. You turn on multiple things. You're often making more than one gene when you open up DNA. So again, I think we're a long ways away. I think what Luis brings up probably is likely to be the earliest area where they may actually be able to do things rather than fixing a disease or a condition. It may be more a way to try to modify or prevent it, because you could take out a bad copy of that gene or a copy of that gene that would have a higher probability of leading to cancer and put in a different copy.
Okay, but I mean, if you were just to take Luis's point and say, look, there's a little section, there's a gene component here, I want it out. And you said, well, you can't just take it out because that'll foul up the sequence of the whole genome. You replace it with something. Does it matter what you replace it with, or is it just a series of neutral features?
You can put the blue eyes back in there.
So it does matter what you replace it with. And the other thing is that, you know, given the way eyes are made, we're not going to take your eyes and turn them brown at this point in time. So you're probably stuck with blue eyes, if that's okay. You have to put something in because you need a gene in there, again, for the same reason.
Well, hang on. You say you need a gene, or do you just need space fillers?
No. See, that's why you can't just do space fillers, because when you start getting into genetics, which is not what this show is supposed to be about, you have introns, you have exons, you have promoters, and many of them work together. So like I said, you often open up multiple genes. You have to stop the translation process. If you don't have the right thing, it's complicated.
Yeah,
won't fix it as quickly as people think.
Okay, but then the conclusion is that the perhaps easiest and perhaps most beneficial use of CRISPR into the future will be the ability to take out a bad gene and replace it with the appropriately quote-unquote good gene. That would be the simplest and perhaps is the major focus at the moment.
From biomedical, but one of the real powers of this tool is just to study basic biology and gene function.
Let me just ask one final question, then we'll move on to something different. Do you do CRISPR-type studies in undergraduate laboratories? Has it got that facile that we can think about actually having an undergraduate laboratory for training people in technology? Okay.
Simply put.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Luis Echegoyen, Welsh Professor of Chemistry at UT El Paso, and Bruce Cushing, the Chair of the Department of Biological Sciences. And we're looking over the last year or two, as a matter of fact, about what are the highlights of science as we perceive them. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Bruce Cushing, Luis Echegoyen. And so, Luis, we've just sort of talked about this CRISPR, which is, you know, I agree with you, it's basic chemistry, but applied to biological sciences. Tell us what you think has been particularly useful this year.
Sure. Before I get into that, I will echo the words of George Whiteside, and I don't want to get into a discussion here, but maybe we should, about, you know, biology has become more and more chemistry because we now have molecular knowledge of what's going on. And when you get into molecules, then you're doing chemistry. So I thought hard about, you know, what happened in 2019 or before 2019, or more I looked into what I think is going to be very important for the future, 2020 and on. And I had a terrible time deciding where I would begin, but I finally decided that I would begin with metal organic frameworks and covalent organic frameworks.
Yeah, I like this combination of metals and organics. It's a classic area of interest.
It's been around for a while.
Right.
And Omar Yagi, whom you may know at Berkeley, he's one of the pioneers. And for the last 5 years, he's been waiting for his Nobel Prize. I think 2020 is going to be, this is my prediction, I predict
that Moths
are going to receive the Nobel Prize this year.
Okay, tell the group out there, the audience, what is a moth?
Yes, so a moth is difficult to describe without having visual content, but you're building the corners, and let's use the simplest geometry of all, which would be a cube. And in the corners of the cube, you have metals. And then the linkers, just the sides of the cube, are organic linkers. So these are carbon-based linkers. And you can vary the size. You can vary everything. And that's the beauty of these materials, that you can really make something that is highly porous.
In a sense, if I can just interject, they're sort of similar to zeolites, where you've got this massive three-dimensional crystal structure with silicons usually in the corners and linked in one way or another by oxygens.
Correct.
The principle is the same, but the components totally different.
Totally different. And the beauty of these materials, it's a single molecule, right? At the end, you have this extended lattice, so it's not just one cube, but cube after cube after cube. So what you end up with is these zeolite materials, or materials with very, very big holes.
And you can define the size of the hole and the passage in, which is key.
And that's the beauty of the whole thing, right?
Yeah.
Now you can put functional groups inside, and you can do catalysis inside, because these pores will selectively grab something, will allow only something based on the size and the functional groups that are flanking the entrance to it. So you can make it exquisitely selective. Only few things go in. And when they go in, you can catalyze reactions. And catalysis is a big subfield within the MOF field. You can selectively remove contaminants, pollutants from the environment.
Yeah. It's like size exclusion chromatography, or size exclusion. Only the things that you want can go in. When you modify them, that's what you can do. But let's just think about that for a moment, because absolutely catalysis is a driving force for everything. I mean, enzymes are nothing more than big catalysts. Very efficient, I might say, compared to what we make in the laboratory. But think of the other aspect that you usually hear along with MOFs is storage. And then it comes to hydrogen storage, and that's one of the big areas, I think.
And continues to be. You can put methane in there. This was the original thing. BASF put a lot of money into this. And it turns out it's something that, food for thought for the listeners, you can pack a gas tank with MOFs, and you can put more methane than you would be able to put if you didn't have them off, which is kind of counterintuitive
right? Indeed.
Because you can pack these things really well inside
due to
the chemical. So you can put more than you would in just the empty tank. But that's another story. But CO2 capture has become big. So if you put amide groups in particular in the inside, these become very selective for trapping carbon dioxide. So
tell us what you think is an amide group.
Should I say C-O-N?
Okay, it's derived from amines with a carbonyl in there.
I didn't want to get into too many details.
No, but I mean, the thing is that they're small, readily accessible molecules.
Yes. And they become very, very selective. You can actually have very, very high concentration of carbon dioxide. So you can capture the CO2 and liberate CO2. Something useful for this area here, recently someone showed that you can actually selectively fish water out of air. So you can actually grab water and then release water just with solar energy. Yes. So for El Paso, this could be very useful.
Except, of course, that as soon as you fish water out of the air, you're fiddling with the environment. You're going to change climate variables. All these things are so complex.
May happen. Yeah. But around here, if you have 25% humidity, which is actually a wet day around here, right? You could fish some of it out, and very, very selectively and very efficiently, by the way. It actually is being commercialized.
You remember both of you down in the Altiplano, down in the Peruvian area. Mm-hmm. That was the way that the indigenous people would get their water, because it never rains, right? But every night it cools down, and they'd have these long strings, metal strings. I'm not sure what the component of the string was, but the condensation, and it was such beautiful technology. It was at an angle, and so the water would condense and drip down into a container. Okay, so moths, you now got a quick lesson in moths, Bruce. Do you see any potential of that for biological systems?
So, yes, and I think that this leads into one of the things that I want to talk about was that climate change, obviously, is one of our biggest challenges, and we're making some advancement in data collection, and what we really need to do is to find ways to sequester carbon, whether it's through planting particular trees, you know, and having changing environments so that you're bringing more carbon into organic, long-term organic structures like trees and things like that, or if you can find a way to capture it. So I think that that's a really big challenge. And if we look at that back at NSF, so one of the other big things that goes along with that and where we might be able to implement that is that with the NEON actually finally being functional, which is a national ecological observatory network, that's a way that there is a large database that's in the U.S. consisting of 81 stations that collect large-scale environmental data, carbon release, and other things like that. So that
you mean and these 81 specific sites,
right,
which sort of represent in total
across the nation in the U.S., and that's an open database, so that all researchers can use it. So this is the kind of thing where I see the type of thing you're talking about, the technology, because if we're going to apply that, we have to really try to understand what we're doing. And I think one of the big advancements with these types of systems is that the data is available for everybody. We're collecting it on a large scale. And if we run experiments, we're starting to reach an interface where I think biology and chemistry, as well as physics and geology, can all work together to really try to come up with a plan to try to deal with these things. Because in the past, it's always been kind of slipshod. We're going to do it here, we're going to do it there, and there's not a real integration. And I think that's the real advancements we need to see for the future, is real integration so we can predict where we're going to go.
Well, let me interject a thought there, because I was at a recent faculty meeting, I think Luis was there too, where the word came down from the higher administration of this institute that we should stop thinking of ourselves as perhaps a chemist, or in my case, an inorganic or organometallic chemist. And I've got to pick from a selection, a theme that I think I can join and be part of a team. So we were developing themes in chemistry. Energy would be one, biomedical science would be another, materials, environment. Is that the way of the future? We'll come back to this in a later program, but I just want to throw it out now. Is that what you're suggesting we need to be doing?
Well, so I might be a good person on the future episode as well. I have my own personal opinion on this, in that I think that our greatest discoveries have been done by individuals, and individuals who think, I don't want to say outside the box, but think differently. And I don't think we ever want that to go away. So I think that finding ways to maintain us as strong individual thought processes, while being able to overlap in some cases, has the best potential. But if you look at historically, team efforts have not produced as many major advancements as individuals have. And I think we're human beings, and I don't think that's going away.
I would like to add something, if I could. I fully agree wholeheartedly that single investigator modality has been the one that served the science in the U.S. and I think in the world best. However, when you constitute these big centers or big places where you have the engineer talking to the physicist and to the biologist and the chemist, new things arise, and they are much more successful in carrying things to completion, meaning developing a product that actually makes it to commercial venture and eventually benefits.
Or social utility. Right,
right. Social utility. That those centers, I think, do much better. The individual just discovered something, you get a Nobel Prize, and then that's the end of that. Yeah, you never carry these things to the end. I think these groups do much better.
Before we leave, my thought is exactly along the lines. I mean, I'm an individual principal investigator, and that's what I wanted to do in my life, you know, and I just want to pick on things that I find of interest. along the line comes training, which is obviously one of the side effects of being a scientist. But I feel nervous about having these themes and that it will curb the individual creativity of the people that go into it, all right? And especially at the beginning of their career, all right? I think, you know, somebody coming out of a PhD has probably done a postdoc for 2 years at this stage, but they need to get on with their passion and then join the theme park a little later on.
But I think they can coexist. Okay. You can continue being your own single investigator group and be a member of a larger group where your ideas mix in with intellectual ideas coming from other fields. And it becomes synergistic. I think the synergy in these centers is an important component.
Good. I think we've come to the end of our first program, and this was very simple, gentlemen. I mean, we've got lots more to talk about. And so to the audience out there, we're going to take a break, but this break's going to last a whole week. So remember to come back next Sunday. You've been listening to Keith Pannell, Luis Echegoyen, Bruce Cushing, talking about what we think or they think, and I interject from time to time, interesting things that have happened over the last year or further back, and where are we going in the future. Well, come back in the future next week, and we'll do another program where we continue this discussion. I'd like to thank Sam Cassiano for putting it on. So, Bruce, thank you very much for being here.
Oh, it was my pleasure, Keith. Thank you.
And Luis, thank you.
Thank you for inviting me, Keith.
And we'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Be there.